This is Dan the Beast Severn, the only Triple Crown champion in the UFC's No Holds Barred era. And you're listening to the Sunday Segway Wrestling Podcast. You had better listen, otherwise, I know where you live.
Well, enough is enough, and it's
time for a change.
It is Sunday, and you're listening to the Sunday Segway Wrestling Podcast.
We're in the big D tonight, baby, and we are live! Woo!
Yes! Yes! Yes!
Don't you dare be sour!
You just made the list!
S-A-W-S-P!
So why don't you choke on that?
Hello, welcome to the Sunday Segway Wrestling Podcast. It's your boy, Kenny Killer. As always, bringing you the best in professional wrestling news and interviews. And we have done it again today. We have none other than UFC Hall of Famer, former WWE superstar. It is none other than Dan the Beast Severn. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm doing fabulously this morning there, Kenny. It's just the start of my day. I'm here in Arizona. The sun is shining. I've been up basically since the crack of dawn, so it's going to be a very productive day. That's all I can say.
Okay, well, what I want to do is thank you for giving us the opportunity to do this interview with you. It's definitely a big one for us because our UK fans are looking very much forward to hearing about your career and what you have planned for the future. So I have my son here, Zaire. Say hello, Zaire.
Hello.
And he wants to ask you the first question. So do you want to ask him the first question, Zaire?
Where did you grow up?
Oh, where did I grow up? Well, basically, I'm born and raised in the state of Michigan. I went originally in the Montrose, New Lothrop areas is where basically I spent probably most of my childhood. It's where I went to school, Montrose High Schools, and that's kind of where I made my mark as an amateur wrestler. And because a lot of people think that I've lived my entire life in Coldwater, Michigan, and all my family and friends back in the Montrose area, they kind of get mad that Montrose never gets any kind of a credit. So I always just tell people that, you know, I'm born and raised in Michigan. I lived in the state of Arizona for a decade, so I kind of consider both states as my home, and because I have family and friends in both states.
So did you get a lot of wrestling in Coldwater? Did you get a lot of wrestling and on the TV as well?
If you're asking really about my interest as a young man, a child, watching professional wrestling, I watched probably most of it around my junior high years. I have seven other siblings, and I have predominantly all males around my age. The first four that were born were all males, so it was pretty easy to grab a workout partner or to grab your brother. Airplane, spin them a few times, then body slam them on the family couch, taking out a lamp in the process. So let's just say that we enjoyed, all of us kind of enjoyed watching professional wrestling. And then, my parents lost a few pieces of furniture because due to us trying to emulate some of these moves. I would have never thought that, roughly, 20 some odd years later that I would actually be engaging in, in that wacky world. And it is a very strange and wacky world, and there are a lot of times when I'm still, because I still do professional matches, that I'm sitting in that locker room and I'm scratching my head and I'm thinking, why am I here?
Well, you have a very, very accomplished career, especially as an amateur wrestler, an athlete in high school and college. Can you explain to the UK fans just how steeped in history amateur wrestling is and how much it is a part of school life? Because it's very different over here.
Yes, I know there's actually several countries, and the UK area is one of those areas where, amateur wrestling is not something strong that is brought up into their school systems. But even then, the United States is very limited. If you look at like a country like Russia, the Russians are still the predominant people in the amateur wrestling field. Because they start right out learning either freestyle or Greco-Roman wrestling, whereas like in the United States, we do this style into our school systems, junior high, high school, and even on the collegiate level, known as folk style. It's closely similar to freestyle wrestling, but still vast differences. And the problem with that is, by the time you graduate out of college, you're 21, 22 years of age, and now, for the first time ever, your really only true opportunity to represent your country are now doing either freestyle or Greco-Roman. So you spent, you know, because in the States, you can start competing competitively at age 4. Now, I don't believe in that at all, because they're children. They don't even know how to share, let alone understand winning and losing. And usually you have some over-enthusiastic father that's in the corner. And on more than one occasion, I wanted to walk over to that dad that is berating their son and grab dad by the scruff of the neck and say, "Dad, what do you want your 4-year-old to accomplish that you never did in your own lifetime?" Because that's really what's happening. They are living vicariously through their children, which there's nothing wrong with that. I have 5 children myself. I have lived through them and have seen, you know, the world through a child's eyes on a number of occasions, just going through my children and things of that nature. But it's a whole different thing when you are looking at your son or daughter, because you think that she was at some back alley cockfight or something like this, the way that you see these men, you know, that how they're yelling and screaming at their child. And that's wrong. But, you know, I'll kind of leave that. But it's, you know, to get really back to your answer to your question, wrestling is a strong part of, I'd say, athletics. It doesn't get the same type of attention such as, you know, football, soccer, basketball, baseball, and hockey, because those are all professional level type sports, and they get a lot of the attention. Wrestling is like gymnastics. There really is not a professional level to move to. When I leave college, I have to leave there with a degree. My aspect cannot be the fact that I could shoot basketball hoops, or I could run the football, or I could hit hockey goals. I mean, or baseballs, and that's where I'll say it's kind of an older stigma, because you don't have that many athletes that slide through in today's era. But I was still in the classroom with guys that they could not write their name, they could not read, and yet they're passing classes only because of their sheer athletic ability.
Okay, nice answer. What was your amateur record?
Well, I couldn't really recite it off the top of my head. There's that one point that I managed to know it by heart, but that's years ago. I mean, honestly, Kenny, I've been a very successful athlete pretty much my entire life. Not starting off for a get-go, because I do a lot of speaking engagements. Motivational type talks, and I used my own career that I did not start off setting the world on fire, but just due to sure diligence of going back and working hard and looking at how I lost matches and then trying to correct weaknesses in my arsenal that made me better and better all the time. It's, I have very few losses literally in my entire career. When you literally sit down to think, and again, I'm talking to you here, I'm trying to even calculate in my mind right now, thousands of matches that I have. When you start combining what I did in my folk style wrestling career, what I did in my freestyle wrestling career, my Greco-Roman wrestling career, then in my freshman year in college, I took a judo class, and then all of a sudden I started jumping into judo competitions, sambo competitions, submission grappling competitions, then jumping into tough man contests, you know, never even owning a pair of boxing gloves, then jumping into going to Japan and doing this crazy thing called shoot fighting or shoot wrestling, and then all of a sudden I'm getting a phone call from the WWF. And then I'm getting, I'm getting this opportunity to go jump in this thing, this really crazy cage thing called Ultimate Fighting, and it's kind of like, I'll say that opportunity after opportunity just was kept coming in and piling on top of each other to where I never really had that chance to think about it. I simply just jumped in and did. So it's 3,500, 4,000, maybe at the low end of matches.
Wow.
I think probably even higher than that because it's during my amateur wrestling career alone, I was getting 50 matches a year during the regulation season, but during the spring and summer, I'd pick up another 100 matches. Now, that's in just 1 year.
Wow.
And, you know, I've been doing the sport of amateur wrestling since 1969. I started teaching it in 71, and by 1972, I won my very first national title. And you were born when?
I was born 85.
I know that most people who I talk to now, I've been competing longer than what they have been alive. And I'm really not slowing down. I'll say I'm slowing down to a certain extent, but I'm being a lot more selective as to what I do because I am the aging athlete, and I want to know what I'm walking into, what are my risk factors, because at this juncture of life, I do not wish to receive some type of physical damage that is going to affect my life for the rest of it or the quality of life that I have left.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, with your amateur career being so great, you were able to, you know, have trials at the Olympics. You didn't get to go to the Olympics. How did this affect you going forward? Did you have any regrets?
You can never say, that question comes up a lot. Do you have any regrets? My stock answer is no, because we cannot go back in time. If there was actually this magical thing that we could do and go back in time, then I would say, yeah, I would prefer to do this, but since we can't, I simply have to say, no, I have no regrets, and I simply move forward. I learn from my mistakes, not only do I learn from my mistakes, I can't even say that. Some of the aspects are out of my hands altogether. Well, for example, I can almost guarantee you right now, you and I would not even be having this conversation today had it not been for what happened to me in the 1984 Olympic trials, because I would have retired in 1984 from athletics altogether. My whole goal was to be the United States Olympic representative at the 220-pound weight class, and I was going to win the gold medal. But instead, I was the alternate. I had to sit there and watch the man ahead of me win the gold medal without giving up a single point. Everybody that he had wrestled, I had pinned in under 1 minute. So it was a real struggle for me because, you know, I know that I was shafted in the process. Even as I talk about it, it brings up such emotion right now that I always tell people, a lot of people make the comment, they're like, wow, dude, you were just such a beast when you climbed in that cage and stuff like this. I go, you don't have a clue what an animal I really was. I said, by the time I climbed into the cage by 1994, I was already one decade past my prime. So if you think I was impressive then, you should have seen me from 1984, especially from 1984 to 1986. I had issues, Kenny. When I would walk out the mat, I would simply know, this match is not going to be close. I will not allow a referee to screw me over or to take something out of my hand. So I was very, very aggressive. I'm a very, very strong pinner, but also in this the essence of being so aggressive, I physically, I'll just say that a number of my opponents end up getting hurt in the process of the match and could not continue the match. Just to give you an idea, in my junior, I'll just talk about my junior and senior years in high school, this high school. In my junior year in high school, I went 51-0, and I had 43 pins. I set a national record for pins, but only 51-0, 43 pins, but only one person that entire season I did not pin.
Wow.
So how did I win? So, there's 51-0, 43 pins, 51. What happened to those other guys? Well, those other guys could not finish the match because I was so aggressive. They had to injury default out of the match. I won because I broke them physically. I broke them mentally. So even, I've always been a person that I live out of a planner. I have lived out of a planner since probably my junior year in high school. And I'm always resetting my goals. So my junior year, I won a state title. It was my first state title. I finished up at fourth place the year before. And so now I'm setting goals for my senior year. So my senior year, my junior year, I finished off 51-0, 43 pins, and only one person the entire season I did not pin. So the new goal that I set for myself in my senior year is simply this. I must pin everyone. So regulation season, I pin everyone. Districts, regionals, states. Now I'm going into the very last match of my high school career. You know, most competitors would like to simply just go to states. You got to realize in the state of Michigan alone, there are over 400 high school wrestling programs. So there are roughly 400 potential champions at your weight class. So what's going to make you different is all the extra work that you do to put in. If your cardiovascular is an issue, all the work you do there. If strength's an issue, all the weightlifting, all the stuff that you have to do outside of practice. Practice is still what you're doing there. So here it is, my final match. As I'm walking to this mat, most athletes would be happy just to have gone to states. Most would be happy shipping to a place that states. Most would be happy if they could win a state title. The folks couldn't believe how I just walked out, just manhandled this person and just, you know, physically just put him down and just pinned him in very kind of, I'll say, brutal and definitive type of a manner.
Okay, so in 1992, you started to wrestle in Japan for UWF, which was the shoot style stuff you was talking about.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to get involved in this, and how were you introduced to the UWF?
Realistically, I had started my first profession was professional wrestling. So I started doing the professional wrestling, and I used my real name and I used my real amateur wrestling credentials. I only had just a very few matches underneath my belt, and I happened to be on a card. And Al Snow was one of my trainers, Body Slammer's Gym. Al Snow, great guy. He introduced me to a female wrestler by the name of Candy Devine. Well, Candy Devine's boyfriend at the time, Dirty White Boy, Tom Burton, was associated with this Japanese organization known as the UWFI. Don't ask me what it all stands for. United Wrestling Something Federation International. I think that's what it stood for. She asked me if my credentials were legit. I said they were. She said, well, you should be doing this thing over in Japan known as Shoot Fighting or Shoot Wrestling. My boyfriend oversees a program down in, I think they was down in Nashville, Tennessee or something like that. And I basically gave her a business card and an athletic resume. 3 days later, I get a phone call from Tom Burton. 10 days later, I'm down in Nashville, Tennessee for a tryout. 30 days later, I'm in Tokyo, Japan, in front of roughly 12,000 people. Don't have a clue as to what I'm doing. All I know is that my Asian opponent kicked me half a dozen times really, really hard, and I'm like, forget this. I just closed the distance, grabbed him, and basically I put on such an aerial assault. They just the Japanese had never seen a man grab another man and just simply bodily fling him all over the place, and I dismantled this guy all in the process, and the crowd went nuts. And even the Japanese interpreter, he looks at me, goes he says, "Don Saban, you will become a superstar in Japan." I go, "I don't know about that superstar, but I'm not gonna let somebody just tee off on me like that with those leg kicks."
Well, you spent a number of years in the UWF and in Japan, also tagging with Gary Albright. But in 1994, you know, we saw the introduction of UFC. What made you decide to look at UFC and think, okay, this is something that I think that I could be very, very good at? And what made you decide to enter the octagon in 94?
Well, I mean, I didn't know I didn't know how well I was going to do. I mean, honestly, I did not tell a single family member. This was shown to me by a friend of mine. You got to realize pay-per-view was not abundant as it is today. Today, you can watch off your cell phone, you can watch off television, your laptops. At this time period, pay-per-views were only available in major metropolitan area cities. And at that time, I was living out in a very, very rural area, Coldwater, Michigan. And a buddy of mine watched the very first two UFCs, and he copied them on an old VHS tape. And he shows them to me, and he says, "You got to think about doing this." And I'm seeing people being soccer kicked in the face. I'm seeing teeth fly on out. Looks like wrestling with pajamas on. I thought, well, a man's got to be within arm's distance in order to punch me. He's got to be within leg distance in order to kick me. I just got to figure, well, I'll either just stay just outside of their range. I use my wrestling ability knowing that that is what I'm good at. I'm not going to try to become something I'm not. I'm not going to sit out there. I mean, I did work on striking. I worked on kicking, you know, more or less how to defend, how to block something on off, and then block and then go right back into capturing and utilizing my strengths. So that's what I did.
Well, you were part of UFC all the way through 94, 95. In 95, you then entered NWA, defeating Chris Candido for the NWA World Heavyweight title, becoming the only man to hold an MMA and pro wrestling world title at the same time. What was it like?
I thought that was Brock Lesnar's lineage.
No. What was it like to do MMA and professional wrestling at the same time? It must have been tough in terms of on your body and maybe family life as well and scheduling.
No, it was. I mean, that's the one thing that if you talk about regrets or things that you'd like to do over, my career, you know, I said earlier, I have five children of my own. I have it goes son, daughter, daughter, son, son. And my kids all know that I would not want any of them to follow in my footsteps, because it was a very hard journey on a family. I was basically an absentee parent for most part of it. I mean, I'd be home during, let's say, the work week, but then a lot of times on the weekends, I'm always gone somewhere. And that's the only time that they're home. Or even in the last, when I first moved down to Coldwater, Michigan, I think it was right around that 1991, fall of 91 type of time period. Even then, I bought this property because of the big storage facility it had to it. I was going to convert it into a training facility because of my love for amateur wrestling. And even then, my kids would be at school during the day, but by the time they get home, I'm out teaching classes in my training facility. And so by the time I'm done teaching and I get everybody out of my training facility here, it's going to be 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and they're in bed and they're sleeping. So literally, even though I am home, they're still not seeing me because dad's working. So that would be, I guess, the hardest part of all this is I had to make decisions. I had to provide for my family, because just to back up a little bit more, you know, I relocated down to Coldwater, Michigan, originally for a job, a corporation-type job. I worked from Arizona State, working being a coach of amateur wrestling. I took a job at Michigan State University, and then from there, I started using my degree, and here I am working in a production company, and I'm part of the quality control staff. So think of Dan Severn wearing a white doctor smock, a pair of glasses, and I got instrumentation making certain that these parts that are being made for the automotive industry. And then that's when he offers me a new position to go down there. And I mean, he's offering me more money, profit sharing, all the bell, buzzes, and whistles that a young married man with a family would like to hear. And I go, well, how much time do I have? 2 weeks. So literally, Kenny, in a two-week period of time, I sold a home, I bought a home, I went to work, and at the end of the first week, I did not have a job.
Wow.
So, and this was, again, right around that fall of 91, 92 cusp. I was trying to make Olympic team still. One of my last rounds attempts to do was trying to make Olympic team. So my world come crashing down, and I'm thinking, you know, I could not find the guy that even hired me. He was missing in action. I end up speaking to an attorney friend of mine. I go, what am I going to do? And he says, well, he says, you don't have any recourse against this company. First thing he tells me, he says, you need to sign up for unemployment. I go, what? I go, I have never done that. I've never done that in my world. I said, how does someone do this? So literally that's when this all hit right around that 92 period of time. A new rule came down from the United States Olympic Committee that allowed athletes to be both amateur and professional simultaneously. So I first started pursuing professional wrestling. Here I am. I'm looking for a job by day, but then by night I'm off training, and I'm training professional wrestling and stuff like this. So I started doing that, and then I aggressively went after things because I had to provide. I had to keep a roof over the head of my family. I had to keep food on the table. There's a lot that my family will never know because I kept them kind of in the dark. Mm-hmm. Because I figure I'm worrying enough for all of us right now. You know, it's that there's a cliche. It's called necessity is the mother of invention. Well, I recoined it. I go, necessity was the father of invention. Because I'm the dad. I'm going to provide. And I even tell people when they say, well, because a lot of people, you know, now they kind of look at me because I'm still a pretty good, solid, athletic-looking type person. Like, oh, like, were you like a football player or something like this? And I go, no. I go, I made money the old-fashioned way. And they'd always say, well, how's that? I go, well, I just beat people up and I take it.
So, again, we're in 98. You know, you're still your NWA champion. And then you signed with the WWE.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw you come out, Jim Cornette, all these belts. I was just, you know, couldn't believe what I was seeing. And then that's at that point, that's when I saw my first UFC fight. You know, my friend gave me a tape and said, oh, you know, this is Dan Severn. I was like, oh, this is Dan Severn. Okay. So how did this come about? You're NWA champion and you signed with the WWE. How did that come together?
Well, I've never been exclusive. I mean, that's part of the irony there, that when I worked for the Ultimate Fighting Championships, I was never exclusive to the UFC. Mm-hmm. When I worked for the WWF, I was non-exclusive. You know, as far as I know, I am the only non-exclusive wrestler ever to have worked for the WWF, the UFC, the NWA. I mean, literally, I never had any exclusivity because each time, and trust me, each one wanted me to be exclusive to them. And I simply just like, what are you going to pay me to sit home? And they're like, well, what do you mean? I go, well, if you're not going to use me this coming weekend, and I have another company that wants to use me, what are you going to pay me to sit home? And like, well, nothing. And then I go, then I won't be exclusive there to you. I go, I cannot at this juncture, because you're going to realize I told nobody about my financial dilemma at that time of not having a job and stuff like this. And even today, even though that happened back in 92, Kenny, as I'm talking to you right now, that is one of the things that motivates me on a daily basis now. I have been self-employed ever since that time period. And so I will thank that for that happening, but at the same token, no, I won't. Because I would have had a whole lot different type of a career. And I think I would have enjoyed myself there as well, because I do like teaching. So I actually left Arizona State with a teaching degree. And think of me as being someone that would have been probably working at on a either junior college or college, or even at the lowest level, I would have been teaching and coaching at a high school level. And I would have been enjoying myself because I still would have been doing my amateur wrestling clinics and camps on the side, because that is still my first love. So I would have had much more family time at that point in time. But like I said, you when adversity is thrown in your direction, the difference that it makes in you and a lot of other people is how do you react to this? Do you simply just lay down and give up? Or does it make you simply just pick yourself up, dust you off, and simply look at it and say, life, is that all? Is that the best you could throw at me? I'm here, I'm still standing, and I'm coming after you. So that's the way I look at it. And that's what people, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, because they still see me, I still go to the gym, I still train and stuff like this. So like, well, dude, what are you training for now? I go, I'm training for the greatest competition in the world. And they're like, well, what's that? It's called life.
Yeah.
I said, everyone wants to live as long as possible, and they want to have quality of life, but if you don't put something into it, how can you ever expect to get anything back out of it? So I look upon it as like an investment.
True.
And that's where I have defied the odds, young in my career, because, again, at 17 years of age in 1976, I am going for my first Olympic berth. And I am stepping on the mat with men that I went to the wrestling camps, their clinics. Moves are named after. I read their books. And now I'm actually on the mat with them. And then I made it to the top six in the country. And, you know, to stay in the top six for that many decades, that's a pretty good accomplishment to stay there. But then that's what I say, that it's helped me to do well in my fighting career, my cage fighting career, all the other types of things that I've done. There's something that I can tap into that a lot of athletes cannot tap into. You're speaking to Dan Severn. But the guy that climbs at that cage, the beast, I'm not a kind man.
So you were in WWE for, you know, just about a year.
Basically, I had a 2-year limited contract is what I had. Again, a very unique contract, but then again, they called me. I didn't call them. I even met with WCW. They called me. I didn't call them.
Wow. Okay, I did not know that. So what contributed to you leaving WWE then?
I'll say probably the easiest way to sum it up is call it creative differences. You know, the life cycle of a professional scene, you're going to be either a face or a heel, but then you'll become the other. You know, I was looked upon more like a face, but kind of a no-nonsense baby face. But then they wanted to kind of turn me more into the dark side, the heel. And what they wanted to do was, okay, I have the ring name The Beast. Now they wanted to put 666 across my forehead, Mark of the Beast. You know, and they wanted to make me an Undertaker disciple when things is nature. I'm thinking, you know, as their creative team is starting to pitch this to me, I put my hands up like this. I'm like, the guy's time out. Not going to happen. I go, if I was one of your normal professional wrestlers and I have nothing else I can contribute, I would seriously contemplate that. I said, I am a man of a reputation. I go, I am not going to destroy my reputation, because if I come in and do this goofy gimmick that you want me to do, and then all of a sudden you guys don't use me anymore, sell my career out for money. Mm-hmm. So I always tell people, you know, even though it's sad for me to say, but I've made more money in professional wrestling than I have in the cage fighting world, and it should be the opposite.
Yeah.
Because one is a real competition, and you really are risking life and limb. You know, professional wrestling, it is an athletic entertainment product. And honestly, I've been hurt worse at that than I have been in my cage fighting career. But that's because you have to put a trust in whoever you're working with. You've got to put your body into somebody else's hands.
What's your relationship like with Ken Shamrock? I mean, you guys have been through a lot, you know, your UFC and then obviously in WWE. So what's that relationship like?
They actually never really knew him. I mean, I've never had this, well, for example, Ken, I've never had this much dialogue as I've had with you. I'll say probably adversarial at best. Mm-hmm. You got to realize, he was in the Ultimate Fighting Championships before I was, and then I came in. And I like to think of myself as the the monkey wrench that hit the system. I mean, I forced people to sell the company because they were running the control. Not that Ken was, but you got the Gracie family and Art Davey that owned this company, and the Gracie family basically was manipulating this company really to sell Gracie Jiu-Jitsu franchises, and it worked. I tip my hat off to it worked, but. I'm the guy that forced them to sell because I came back in UFC number 5 as a wrecking machine. When I walked up to UFC number 4, I only trained for 5 days, an hour and a half a day, and my training camp was a joke. I don't even call it a training camp. It was just called comedy for 5 days, an hour and a half a day, and I climbed into a cage. And not another human being will ever be able to match what I have done when you look at my entire career, period. But getting back to Ken, I don't know the guy to say that I like him or dislike him, but I really do not look upon him in a very favorable light. Matter of fact, I simply refer to him as the sham anymore because his word means nothing to me, and his word should really mean nothing to him with any of the companies that he works with because he gave his word to a company that he was going to do a match with me, and he as part of that agreement. And then he selects to do a match with Hoist Gracie on a Friday night, and we were always scheduled to be on that Sunday. How in the world are you going to do a fight for Bellator on a Friday night and then do a match with me on a Sunday? So it's I'll really sum it up. A lot of people keep bringing his name up and associate with me. I go, I don't want him associated with me. He is not in my category. The biggest difference between the two of us, I am lifetime chemical free. You find another human being that can walk this planet, whether currently or deceased, and that can do or make the claims of all the things that I have done, it will never be done. And I'm not done yet. I'm still planning on adding a few more feathers to my cap before I turn over, and I will still do it chemical free.
Well, you're 58 years old young, and you're still wrestling, you're still fighting, and I know you fought up and coming Matt Riddle about a month ago maybe.
I always put in categories so to say I wrestled Matt Riddle. I always say there's a big difference between fighting and wrestling.
Okay. To finish up the interview, what I want you to do is just let the UK fans know about the Danger Zone and what you guys got coming up for the future as well, and let them know where they can find you on all social media.
Okay, just a couple of things coming up. On May 5th, we have our Cinco de Mayo show taking place. When I say we, I run my own MMA company, and it's called Danger Zone MMA. Folks can simply just go to Facebook page, Danger Zone MMA, and all the information will be on there. Now, the folks that are within the general proximity of Auburn, Indiana, they can find out the ticket information, and it's called cagetix.com/DZ, but it's cage as in C-A-G, tix, T-I-X, .com/DZ for ticket information. But I just keep telling people, just go to Facebook page, Danger Zone MMA. It's all right there. If you're in the UK and you still want to watch the event, there is internet pay-per-view that's still available with it as well, so you can watch the thing at the same time that it will be taking place live. Now, granted, it will be a five-hour time difference. I have my own professional wrestling company known as POG, Price of Glory. That will be coming up on June 3rd in downtown Coldwater, Michigan. That's a very family-friendly product that we put on. It's kind of like a step back in time where I want characters, and these characters are playing to a very younger age so that moms and dads know that they can bring their sons and daughters there, and they can have a very interactive experience where the kids can cheer and they can boo, and the wrestlers will get up there and be frothing and pointing stuff like this, and the kids can get right back up in their face and stuff like that just as well, but they're all behind the barricades of nature. So it's a very family-friendly product that we do there. Michigan Sports Camps Training Facility, that is my name on my training facility located in Coldwater, Michigan. As far as I know, I am the only training facility that has amateur wrestlers, professional wrestlers, and cage fighters all underneath one roof. Eventually, I will be going after a reality show because of that unique dynamic. I represent like the reality shows of Tough Enough and The Ultimate Fighter, but they're both underneath one roof. But then I have, then again, you throw in the amateur wrestlers and then just some of the other unique characters that I have. And the most unique characters are definitely in the wacky sport of professional wrestling. These are, I always credit professional wrestling for waking up the creativity that I never knew existed, but I am a pretty creative person anymore, and I give professional wrestling that thanks. On top of the things I've mentioned here, I have my own book that is out. It's titled The Realest Guy in the Room, The Life and Times of Dan B. Severn. That came out last July, and within the first 2 weeks, it went to Amazon.com's number one bestseller. I will have a book number two probably coming out, probably in 2018. I'll probably just get to work with it towards the later part of this year. I just got too much. I literally have over 1,000 pages in a notebook that I've just been jotting down stories over years, that, and we only use a fraction of it for this first book. On top of that, I do stuff with law enforcement, corrections, air marshals, border patrol, military, and as far as I know, I'm still the only private citizen ever to be brought on base to the world's largest private security company. And my gift is physical mechanics. That's why, when you look at me right now, you realize that I'm not war torn here in the process, Kenny. I'm not. You don't see any cauliflower ears on me. My nose still sits in the center of my face. My teeth, although they're crooked, they've always been crooked, they're still originals. I always say that the money maker is a testimony of the fact that I have not been hit very many times and I have not taken any damage. As a matter of fact, just the fact that you can have an intellectual conversation with me. Bottom line, there are only four people in the world that have over 100 cage fights. I'm one of the four. There's only three people in the world that have over 100 victories. I'm one of the three. Now, the ironic part is, I faced the other three, I defeated the other three, and the closest one to my age is 15 years my junior. Wow. So it puts me in a category all by myself. And I'm not trying to say that, because I tell people, the book name itself, The Realest Guy in the Room, I did not make that up. The gentleman that helped kind of organize it, the book there with me, his name is Ian Douglas. He helped. He goes, dude, you just got too much material. But he was a big fan of professional wrestling, big fan of MMA. He goes, those will be our two key areas that we'll touch on, and we'll touch a little bit on your growing up, a little bit on the amateur wrestling, and that's about it. I take more pride in what I did in my amateur wrestling career and representing the United States, and none of it was for money. It was simply just for the proud fact that I could climb up on the top of the podium and have my flag, my country's flag raised and the playing of the national anthem. So, those are things that I give a lot more credit to, credence that actually have helped to form the person that I am. So basically, another long answer. If you want to know more about what I have going on, if you want to know about more of my social media outlets, simply by going to my website, DanSeverin.com, DanSeverin, DanSeverin.com. You will find out all that I have going. One last point I would like to bring out is that I just had a professional wrestling group that reached out to me because of what happened through that WrestleMania weekend and because of that match with Matt Riddle and things of that nature, that they have a group that has reached out to me to come to the UK for the September 15th, 16th, 17th weekend. So I don't have a location yet, but they've contacted me already via email, and that is the weekend that they're looking at, September 15th, 16th, 17th. But rest assured, it will be announced through my Facebook page when I know that will be taken. So this might be a chance for a lot of UK fans to actually meet me in person.
That's great. So Dan, I'd like to again thank you for giving us the opportunity to interview you. I hope everything goes well with your career. I mean, long may it continue, and good luck with everything coming up.
Well, thank you very much, Kenny, for having me on, and Rest assured, the Beast won't be sitting in a rocket chair anytime soon.